I teach at Seattle University Law School, and my colleague Marilyn Berger has been using the book Civil Action for about 3 years. And actually, we were lucky enough to have Jan come visit our law school about a year ago before his schedule was really not happening with speaking engagements. And it occurred to me then that Jan Slickman is sort of like a human one-shot test, an inkblot test. A lot of people see different things in him, and it almost says more about you than him. I remember talking about him with my colleagues, and thought he did a terrible job, and I thought, no, he did a terrible job, and he really threw himself into it. And so, I think he, different aspects of his character and his performance of the case resonate differently with different people. So, with that, I will turn it over to the human hate block test.
I think that's very true. I think I feel that very much the same thing. So many different adjectives that have been used to describe it. It's a wonderful experience, to have a book and a movie, written about you or a movie made about you. And if you're, I urge all of you to have that done because you'll finally get to hear from people you've never met, will probably never meet, but they'll send you, through the newspaper or the electronic waves, they'll send you a description of yourself. And so I've learned that I'm, flamboyant and charismatic. Yeah, okay.
I teach at Seattle University Law School, and my colleague Marilyn Berger has been using the book Civil Action for about 3 years. And actually, we were lucky enough to have Jan come visit our law school about a year ago before his schedule really got hectic with speaking engagements. And it occurred to me then that Jan Slickman is sort of like a human one-shot test, an inkblot test. A lot of people see different things in him, and it almost says more about you than him. I remember talking about him with my colleagues, and thought he did a terrible job, and I thought, well, no, he did a terrible job, and he really threw himself into it. And so, I think he, different aspects of his character and his performance of the case resonate differently with different people. So, with that, I will turn it over to the human hate block test.
I think that's very true. I think I feel that very much the same thing. So many different adjectives have been used to describe it. It's a wonderful experience, to have a book and a movie, written about you or a movie made about you. And if you're you know, I urge all of you to have that done. Because you'll finally get to hear from people you've never met, will probably never meet, but they'll send you, you know, through the newspaper or through electronic waves, they'll send you a description of yourself. And so I've learned that I'm, you know, flamboyant and charismatic. Yeah, okay. Insensitive, arrogant, greedy, materialistic. I've been called one LA paper called a heartless huckster. Time magazine, when they reviewed the book, called me a humorless vulpine. I don't think I'm humorless. Vulpine, I had to look up, you know, it says an endangered predator. I guess I probably was. And then say, you know, then they'll give me this whole list of adjectives, and I'm going to say, you know, who at the end of this experience became almost human. I definitely did evolve. My character definitely evolved. And I have to say, you know, I spent time listening to Jerry speak, and it was a wonderful experience, really, to hear him share, you know, his views and his experience. It certainly was a little gift, you know, for me to hear, because it just, you know, makes you think back on that period of time and you know, it just rounds out, you know, the blank spaces or fills them in, and it gives you a much richer appreciation for the past. Hopefully you can do something about it for the future. Which is basically the basic thing that I learned through this whole experience is this, you know, that we learn when we share experience, and we tend to get it right, and we don't when we don't share experience, and we tend to get it wrong. That's been like the ultimate lesson of woman. But that has fundamentally changed me on a personal level and on a professional level. So now, and I want us to spend time asking, you know, having you ask the question so that I can make sure that we're connecting here and you're getting the kinds of information you want to hear. But I think what you'll find out is that, and certainly many of you who have, you know, been hearing me out there ranting and raving or pontificating, is that it always comes back to this, this experience so profoundly changed me, so gave me such a, well, a new vision of the truth, you know, is how I'd like to express it, that it just makes me go about being a person and a person trying to be a lawyer differently. And so, you know, I think there's like, there's two discussions that can go on here and should. One is the discussion which is confined to the, well, to the world that we lived in or that I lived in then. And those are, you know, we can talk about strategic decisions and would you have done this differently and what do you think about that? And I think that's all, you know, and I would like very much to engage in that discussion to the extent you want to. But to me, the more interesting discussion is the one that I truly am interested in, which is that, you know, this was a war, you know, and so much of litigation, maybe all of litigation, is warlike, and it brings out all those kinds of warlike activities. And at the end of this war, which was the biggest war that I ever fought in, lasted 9 years, you know, I ask, like veterans of most wars who survived war, why war? And when you ask that question, you just don't go back into the courtroom, the same person. You don't want to go back to the courtroom because you just realize that it's such a destructive place. And after having your whole belly full of destructive activities where time and people and things were wasted, and then you also appreciate that the problem that we have here is so essential to our existence, then it just makes you want to look for other things to do. And as I have gone about that, looking for other ways to deal with this problem, people have responded, you know, and some of these people have been lawyers. Lawyers for the other side, in particular, who are also sense the same kind of need to figure these things out because it's so important to us as human beings, whatever we are, whether we're corporations, government people, or you know, community members, or whatever it is. So anyway, that's the, you know, that's my main feelings. But let me open up the questions, and we can deal on any level you wish. There are things you would like to talk about.
Could you explore a little bit what was going on during the post-trial Rule 60 motion with the judge choosing an expert to investigate the Cannery property?
Oh, yeah, you're really delving into detail there. That was, you're talking about when the judge ordered an independent investigation of the property? The, basically what had occurred was that in July, we had this initial 60B3 hearing, which was on the extent of information that had been withheld, you know, what else was out there and all that other kind of stuff. That ended in July. The judge made findings that there had been deliberate withholding of the information And then we were supposed to then go about the significance of that information was going to be the second phase. But the judge wanted to avoid the second one, and he called us in and he said, look, why don't we just find out if the tannery property is contaminated? Because if in fact it's not contaminated, then whether or not information was withheld or whether or not it would have been significant in the abstract, it wouldn't make any difference if in fact the property is not contaminated. And if in fact it was contaminated, then this information would be significant. So that was his basic premise. Now we had problems in that, and what he wanted to do that, he wanted to have a so-called independent investigator do it. And he asked each side to submit names. And we didn't like that process because we felt that there's no such thing as an independent investigator. That's a myth. Jerry talked about myths. I'll add that one to the myth. Ain't no such thing. Nobody's independent. And also we felt that, that each side should do their own investigation. And that gave, better hopes that for credibility of the operation as opposed to having this, idea that somehow someone's going to be independent. So we didn't participate. But the judge did appoint someone. And it turned out that the thing was going to cost, $450,000. It's going to take many, many months. And also, it was just very clear to us that the person that was selected was just not really independent. Because in the world of engineering that he was choosing from, they're all interconnected. So there's just no, such thing as independent. And so we brought that to his attention. And I think because of the cost and because it's impossible to have, someone who is, I think the judge agreed at that basis. Then he went to the second phase. Again, it was this, that was basically what occurred. All right. Yes.
Yeah, in the story that comes from the book, one troubling aspect is there were a number of settlement offers that you rejected without going to the client. And do you have any thoughts about that? In retrospect, you've done that differently.
Well, yeah, but there wasn't. There really wasn't so-called settlement offers that were not given to the clients on a couple levels. First of all, there was certainly a lot of dancing about settling, and I had many conversations with Neil Jacobs in particular. And the very famous conversation with Jerry throwing the ball in his office, which has been transmogrified into the the corridor discussion in the movie. But and I'm very pleased to hear Jerry describe that because that was been very much my analysis of it. When he took out people look at the film, for instance, and they say, oh, that's a $20 million offer, and how could you have turned that down? And my answer is that, well, it wasn't an offer; it was a test. And I thought that Jerry's, kind of description from his perspective, too, was very enlightening, too, because I think, I take that as also agreeing that it wasn't an offer, it was a test. And so much of what we did with each other was testing each other. And that's basically my, when I play that tape over and over again, that we were in a context of in which we were, looking at each other as warriors and probing for weakness. And in that context, it was very, very difficult for people to have the one thing that I think you need to solve all disputes, that's an open and honest discussion, or some sort of openness and honesty with each other. And we didn't really have that because there was just so much at stake and the way we were looking at our different roles. So in all of our discussions, while it was certainly clear to me that they were signaling to me, some area in which they might be willing to settle, there was never a formal offer that, okay, we're now making this offer to your clients and you go back. Now, as a matter of fact, my clients are here, some of them are here in the room, and so I'll say this in their presence because I know they will not disagree with me. We had many discussions in which I talked exactly as I'm talking to you about that, that possibility. In other words, that, listen, they're sending all these signals, about this case settling and, we're talking about perhaps a few million dollars or something like that. We're giving them, what we were estimating where they were, but nobody has made some formal, some formal offer. And this was something we did together. I valued the relationship with my clients, with the families, and we looked at them as our partners in the process. And although there was tremendous pressures on us, and this was a war, we met all the time, and I think that they felt that I was, here's one, and she can say if I'm right or wrong, but I think they felt that we had a good relationship and that there was open communication, that they were very aware of where things were going along the way. So I don't really think that it was a question of, oh my God, there was this money, how come you didn't tell us about it? Nobody has ever said it to us because I don't think anybody ever felt in any way deprived of any kind of information what was going on. But we were never put in a position where they had to make a choice to accept or reject. It just was never never occurred. And if I missed any, is Neil here?
Mm-hmm.
He's all right. Now, if I'm wrong, Neil, you let me know whether there was a, you know, such a time. He came very close, and there's no question that if I had done certain steps, you know, if I had said certain things, I could have certainly turned it into an accept or reject. I have no doubt about that. You know, that meeting in particular that occurred with, help me, Neil, what was the general counsel from
Beecher?
Mary Allen. Yeah. And when she broke her pencil, you know, and writing down where we were, I mean, that was our fault. You know, that meeting could have been far more constructive. Well, I mean, I look at that meeting as the meeting in which if had, you know, I had more wisdom, perhaps more experience, but certainly more wisdom, I would have been able to have done things that would have allowed that case to resolve at that point. It would have, you know, I think from a strategic standpoint, that was the opportune time to do it, had the most amount of leverage at that time. I had general counsel was right there, willing to pay, you know, substantial sums of money. And had I taken, you know, been, you know, like I say, more wise about what was going on, I have no doubt we would have come to a resolution, and Beecher's would have been out of the case, and this case would have had a, you know, tremendously different thing, you know, a different course. But it didn't occur. For lots of reasons. Maybe they hinted at it at the movie, and I offered, you know, the book. I think each one can have their own interpretation. You know, what our expectations and what we were trying to accomplish in the case, and also figuring that if, in fact, Beatrice got out, which we considered to be the, you know, the major polluter, the one closest to the wells, and which so much energy and emotion and passion had also been devoted, and we thought we had the least information, you know, all those things combined to... you know, and then the worry that whatever that settlement was would come back to haunt us with grace. And so kind of all those things, you know, made me a little more distant, a little more removed, and not, you know, taking that opportunity and squeezing all the juice that I could out of it. And so, you know, that's one of the, those are one of the tapes that I play and say, yeah, that's where you blew it. You know, you could have done something there different and probably should have in a strategic sense, you know, for the case. Yeah.
You use the word war. When I think of war, though, I think of something that's just inhumane and random and very dangerous and deadly.
You just described the Woburn case.
But when I think of law, just as single words, I think of something much more rational and hopeful. So obviously I'm naive here. But
are you a practicing lawyer or law professor?
No, I'm a
teacher. Ah, all right. Okay. All right.
So my question is, if you could expand on...
Sure. Why is it war? Or why do I use that kind of a metaphor? Well, because I think that a contract was, you know, I think that about a few hundred years ago, they had gotten a little tired of the peasants, you know, storming the walls every time they felt it was a great wrong done, and they came up with this idea and said, look, everybody who's got a pitchfork, you trade in for a lawyer. And everybody says, oh, well, what's a lawyer? Oh, he's, you know, we have this lawyer, and he'll do all the fighting for you. Oh, and I don't have to worry about getting, you know, all right, that sounds good. They gave up the pitchforks and got lawyers. And so every time you need to storm the walls, they send lawyers up there, you know, and lawyers to fight them off. I think that, you know, we have, you know, that we call it a trial for a reason. And the trials, you know, the word trial comes from, you know, when we would take human beings. You know, it was this kind of vision we had of the truth. The truth was something that you extracted from those who wished not to allow it to be extracted, you know. And so trial was taking a human being and putting them on trial physically. That would either be, you know, answer the question, we separate you from your skin, answer the question, we break all your bones, answer the question, we put on more stones, you know. And so, you know, we wrest the breast from the, wrest the truth from the breast of the other with the cry of more stones. I mean, that is the classic way our 16th century value system looks at how you get the truth, something that's extracted. And that has permeated the law ever right to this very day. What is happening in Washington right now? But this extraction, you know, when they get on the television, oh, this is all about the truth. We must have the truth. We will have the truth. Right. Put her on the stand. Put him on the stand. You know, and then you know, that's our way of extracting from them. Pains and, you know, we love our perjury with pains and penalties. It's the only way us lawyers like perjury. It's not perjury without pains and penalties. There must be pains and penalties for perjury. And perjury, of course, serves the truth, right? Baloney. perjury is a concept that does not serve the truth. It serves this other darker thing inside us. You know, this it serves power, not the truth. Truth doesn't need perjury. See, the truth's all around us. And it comes to us when we share experience. It really is that simple. And we never get to the truth by destroying things. You destroy the truth when you do that. And it took me a long time to kind of understand that. Now, I lived in a world, in the Woburn world, and the war world, and the world of litigation, looks at the truth as a commodity. It has value. It has value to those who possess it, and therefore those who want it want to keep it, and those who don't want to take it from those who do. You know, and when you have one who has something they don't want to give up, and another who wants something that the other doesn't want to give up, you got violence, you got conflict, you know, you got war. And that's when you bring in the lawyers to settle the score. So that permeates our system. And so in a litigation mode, here's what you get. Now, I've been a plaintiff, and I've been a plaintiff's attorney. I've been a defendant, and I've been a defendant's attorney. And I can tell you it's ugly any way you look at it, up, down, or sideways. I have, I have not wanted to give up information. I have wanted to take information. I remember this one moment in the discovery period, by the way. It was far more corrosive, bitter, violent than the trial was civilized compared to the discovery thing. Discovery, it was, you know, bare knuckle. I mean, we were out to get each other. You know, this was, I remember, our clients had just gone to be examined. It had just happened. And I remember they wanted those reports fresh. They wanted, you know, any of the notes of the doctors and everything. And I remember it was the order came down at 2 o'clock that afternoon, and the magistrate ordered that those documents had to be turned on the other side by 5 o'clock. I had never seen these, you know, they had just been collected. And I remember in my office sitting there with a whole pile of documents, and I'm looking through them, and the phone is ringing, you know, every 15 minutes. Are you going to provide these documents? You know, are you going to show up at 5 o'clock? Are we going to send somebody over there at 5 o'clock? You know, are we going to come over? Are you going to come over here? You know. You know, and I remember the pressure of the phone calls and going through the thing and not knowing, and I say, you know, and then I said to myself, you know, at 4:45, what's going on here? Why am I have this feeling, this pressure that I got to go check everything before I give it over to them? If I find something, am I going to remove it? I mean, so why am I feeling this pressure? If there's something in here that destroys my case, well, then maybe I don't have a case. And if there's something in here that supports my case, well, great. But either way, who am I to worry about what's in there except give it to them? So I gave it to them. But that told me a lot about me and how I was looking at the world. You know, and that's how we do, you know, this need for control. And we have staked out a position. In litigation, you stake out a position. Now, in the Woburn case, we staked out a position nobody ever staked out before. You know, and we actually had to fund original scientific and medical research. So we staked out a position based on faith, in fact. But a lot more faith than fact. And then we went through this process in which we started to, you know, turn the faith into fact. No, we did. Our faith, I believe, was well placed. I'm glad we did that. But, you know, it was in this kind of pressure cooker of litigation. And litigation brings out all of the worst in us, just like war does. And it's because we look at the truth as a commodity to be fought over. One side has to win, one side loses. Truth is a weapon. Truth is something you can bury in a bottomless pit. I believe that, so I thought I had to go into that dirty and dangerous place and dig it all up, no matter how deep I had to go, you know, and how dirty I had to get. I had to get at that truth. And in fact, I actually had to get dirty physically, and I had to actually go into those pits, you know, to do it. And they are dirty and they are dangerous in order to bring out this, what I thought was a valuable commodity people would pay a lot of money, you know, to possess. But I came to appreciate that you can't bury it, and you can't unbury it, because it is all around us. And when we start thinking in terms of it as a commodity, divorced from reality, then we're missing the point. Truth is reality. So reality is absolutely essential for us to solve our problems. When lawyers deal with reality from the perspectives, you know, from each of their different perspectives, then cases get resolved. When lawyers engage in delusion or feed the delusion of their clients, then usually have long, drawn-out legal battles, what we call litigation, and it goes on into places that nobody you know, can imagine, and they're terrible places.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer. I'm there. I say that's a witness, and I consider it super fun litigation and so forth. And the sense I get as an expert scientific witness is that many attorneys don't view it as the oral, as a game. And the game is to win. And I can recall one case where it was involving a Superfund site where I was having a very candid discussion with my attorneys over the case and had to deal with how far, as a scientist, I'd be willing to testify in one way or the other because of the logical difference in the data and different ways of interpreting it. And I remember this particular attorney, a very famous firm, said to me, well, you have to understand, no one's going to go to jail over this issue. It's only a matter about money. Whether this big company pays it or the insurance company pays it, it'll be all, you know, spread out amongst the consumers. And the idea is that we really want to win this case.
Right.
And in the sense I get from all the expert work that I've done, and even some cases where I've been a defendant, is that it's like a chess game.
Right.
Where you've got all the pieces on the table, and everybody, well, some, you don't know what the strategy is, but it's largely there, and it's who's the better player. And I often teach this in my classes, that it's viewed by many people as a game, and not so much as a war. I mean, the adrenaline rush of winning, and getting on the stand, and going combative with lawyers, I guess, you know, it's really...
Well, I'll give you an example of that time. We had this pump test, you know, Wells GNH had to be turned on. So for 30 days, and now think of all those parties there. There was the governments, you know, state and federal. There were the companies and all of their lawyers and the families and their engineers and lawyers. And now we are all in a room because we all had to figure out what was going to happen during this pump test. Now I remember this image of the lawyer standing up and saying, "Well, my engineer would say this about that," and you could look at their engineer, you know, going. And then the lawyers are getting all heated, you know, well, am I going to know, and it's going to be this, and you're wrong, and no, it's going to come to blows. So the lawyers went out of the room, you know, to work it out, and when we came back, the engineers, of course, all talked to each other, and whatever that problem was, they worked it all out. And I remember thinking to myself, gee, what do they know that we don't? You know, what's going on? Well, why is their discussion different than our discussion? And to me, their discussion was based on data that they respected. To them, the data is the data. And so, you know, when you take the lawyers out, then they're left with the data and whatever the data is, you know. And so there's much more of that than there is of the advocacy. And so to me, that's very revealing. Now, I believe that the lawyers are at their best when we are honest with ourselves and with our clients about, you know, the data of the world, you know, based on our life experience. Well, you know, here's the reality of this. You know, you did this. You know, you say they did that to you, but you did this. You know, you have to understand that. You know, when we have that kind of open and honest discussion about the data of life, there's enlightenment for you, the client. And all of a sudden, when you sit in a room and another lawyer is doing the same thing with their client, and then the lawyers and the clients are then begin to do it together, all of a sudden, you know what happens? People get kind of a working consensus about what really happened, the good and the bad and the ugly of it, and all of a sudden, it gets solved just like that. And it gets solved in record time. And you take the same problem and you say, hey, listen, you had a partnership, now you're dissolving, then somebody must be at fault, let's give you each a lawyer and you can go fight over it. Now, if you're married, you know, your partnership is dissolving, what a wonderful way to resolve a, you know, a divorce, is to get lawyers in there so you can litigate it, right? I'm sure all of you who have had that experience think that was probably one of the finest experiences you ever had in your life. What genius thought that up? Now, it doesn't work there. It doesn't work if a partnership, a business partnership is resolving. It doesn't work if a community partnership between companies and government and communities are also dissolving or in an uproar over a particular problem. It doesn't work, period. It just doesn't work. This seminar is working because we're all sitting here sharing experience. It does not work if one side, you know, this side has to win today and this side has to lose today and you've got to stake out a position. That's not conducive to revealing things.
Mellower
than. No, just not mellower. Well, yes.
And let's say because you're still doing environmental
right.
Litigation, that you wanted us to sit down and join hands and say, let's see how we can look at that.
Right.
You had to have had the war with Beatrice and Grace, or at least with Grace, first. Because there isn't, I don't think, a corporation in America who would sit down with you without finding a liability from some against somebody.
Well, that's the premise.
Grace and Beatrice.
Right.
Back in the early 80s.
I never would have.
Well, even if you would have. What do you think you would have done?
I would have probably sat in the room by myself. No doubt about that. And not that they're going to do it because they want to. And I'm also, you know, when people hear me talk like this, they say, well, we like the older, you know, the old Jan, you know, I like that new Jan. You know? Come on, you know, spend the next 9 years of your life fighting for us. You know, give up everything, including your sanity. That's the lawyer we want. Right. And I'm saying, well, you know, if you want a problem solved, you know, here's how it gets solved. Now, I'm not saying that it's going to work every time. But it's going to work far more often than now. I know this is true because I've done it. Why do they? Why does anyone come to a room? Why does anybody come to therapy? You know, I mean, I can imagine that you say, "Look, you need to go to therapy, so we're going to put a subpoena out on you. We're going to subpoena to the doctor, and under the pains and penalties of perjury, you're going to give him a history." No one can imagine how effective that therapy is going to be. And if you give the wrong answer, by the way, you're probably going to go to jail, or you're going to be, you know, have to spend huge sums of money. So it doesn't that model doesn't work. Now, as far as I'm concerned, when you have a contamination problem, when you wake up one morning and find that the water that you think is safe is not, but it's contaminated, and you have a sick child, or you know that your neighbor has a sick child, and it raises the question in your mind, all of a sudden what you have come to is you realize now your community is sick. There's a pathology in the community. It has afflicted your child, your neighbor's child. There is a sickness. How do you get well? How do you get well? And the only way I know how to get well is if you understand how you got sick. If you understand how you got sick, that gives you at least a chance to figure out, well, how can I get from the sick place to the healthy place? Now, I believe that, you know, medical metaphor, if you want to call it, natural or life metaphor, is more clear in solving, it offers more hope for solving the problem than the conflict-based problem-solving, so-called, metaphor that we all are very familiar with, the litigation kind of model, you know, looking for blame. It's this need to understand the past so that you can have a future. Now, as soon as you come to that decision, regardless of whether people want to go to the room or not, at least accept the fact that if they go to the room, if they go, whatever their motivation, whatever brings them in there, if they go to the room and sit down, and they have an open and honest discussion to the extent that human beings can have in that situation, that's hard, and the lawyers are actually helping, producing an open and honest discussion, does that not offer an opportunity for people to understand the past? The answer is yes, there's no other way to do it, but to have a place like this, where you have an open and honest discussion to the extent you're going to have one, if you can understand the past, so you can be wiser about tomorrow than you were about today or about yesterday. So my challenge as a lawyer representing communities is how do you get a context in which people are willing to go into a room to have that? Now, Toms River, New Jersey is a perfect example, and I think it works very, very well. I finished the Woburn case. Now it's quite exhausted. And then the book came out. And then the phone calls. And like I say, always on a Sunday. And, you know, and they'd say, I read the book about how you gave up everything, including your sanity. You sound like just a lawyer for me. You know? And, you know, come on. You know, hey, we got a case for you. And I say, no. But then this woman from Toms River, a mother, it's always the mothers, called up and said, you know, we got contaminated water, like Woburn. We got a lot of children with cancer, like Woburn. We got two companies. It's always two companies. I don't know why it's two companies. Two big companies. I don't know why it's always two big companies. Implicated in the pollution. We think you may have learned something. Come down, you know, would you share what you learned? Okay, didn't say no, and I did. At the end of that discussion, they formed an organization called TEACH, Toxic Environments Affect Children's Health. 60 families, all with children with cancer. Then we went to the state and federal government and offered a partnership. We'd work together as partners to kind of figure out, answer these questions. And then we went to the companies, knocked on their door. Who should answer the door? But one of the lawyers, Neil knows him very well, works for one of the big companies. He worked with Neil in the teacher's case. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. How am I going to talk to this guy? Well, of course, we had lots to talk about, and we did. And at the end of our discussions, here's what we did. We entered into an agreement. I call it a partnership agreement, 18-month partnership agreement. It says that for 18 months, no legal action, and all rights are preserved, and we're going to use that period of time to just sit down and share information to the extent we're able to do it or willing to do it in the hopes that we can get some. Is we're building up relationships of trust. We are trusting each other. We're, you know, and it's taking a long process. And there's very, you know, nobody should sugarcoat this. It's very there are very powerful interests involved, lots of emotion and passion, as there should be, and lots of diverse interests, opposing interests, at least on their surface. You know, intractable, at least on their surface. It at least offers us an opportunity that if we build this relationship of trust and we begin to share information so we have some, and we haven't staked out positions politically, economically, publicly, that force us not to look at data when the data doesn't agree with us, then at least offers us an opportunity that we just might help each other not make a mistake. Help each other not dissolve the partnership, but continue the partnership in a constructive way that identifies legitimate interests and accommodates everybody's interests. It's just a healthier way of dealing with the problem. And it allows an opportunity for its solution, as opposed to the old traditional way, which is I would have gone down there, signed them up, and filed a lawsuit, and I'd be telling you, you know, additional war stories. Oh, I'm going to do this differently. Oh, we're going to go down the hill this way. You know, we're not going to start the cannonade until 6 in the evening. You know, I mean, all that kind of stuff. And we'd all be reveling in the details of that romance.
Let me talk about the cold chain.
Yeah, go ahead. Sometimes my tail pops out here.
Vis-a-vis the client.
Yes.
The lawyer is all-powerful.
Yeah.
Everything a client hears is through the lawyer's lens. So sometimes the lawyer's agenda controls what occurs during a litigation.
Absolutely.
Now, this is an extremely interesting case because now we have this book and the clients were able to read the book. So they have a retrospective that most clients never ever get.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wonder, the clients that are here, if they would comment, having read the book, I'm sure, and having lived this horrible incident in all kinds of ways, what, do they agree that this fellow here, the old jam, somehow distorted or somehow didn't have all the information? That information wasn't as forthcoming as it otherwise could have been.
So somebody was holding back from them?
The information.
All the information
to make the choices.
Right.
That's the worst choice that could be made.
The information that you think you came through your
My distorted, dirty lens. Guys, Gabby, let me have it.
I need a couple notes on that. I wasn't here last night. I talked to Donna out in the hallway about Jerry's speech, and I guess he had made a point last night of saying that this case was all about money. As we sat here, I thought, I wish that it could be known that the money wasn't the important issue. For me, the book and this movie has made a statement, and it's now going to make it easier and for other people, other communities with terrible problems, to find some solution to keep the citizens safe. I feel that the government has failed us miserably, keeping our community safe. And maybe Jan didn't go about it the right way the first time. I don't know. I thought he did a wonderful job with an impossible case. But he's brought this environmental issue to the forefront, and he's breaking new ground to keep the American public safe. And I think that we should be saluting him, not second-guessing whether he came to the clients with every little picayune piece of information.
I'm unsolicited.
That's on tape? Thank you. That was very sweet of you. I appreciate it. We had I have to say that, you know, there are some, what people I think should appreciate is that our relationship with the clients was very, very strong and only got stronger through this process. And my relationship with my former partners who remained and my closest friends, are things that I value absolutely tremendously. I think it's just a testament to, you know, the kinds of people involved here and what we went through and everything, that with all the pressures that everyone had, there was this fundamental respect and love, you know, for each other, that only grew deeper, I think, you know, through the experience. And with all the problems that we had, and we had many, they really were trivial compared to what we accomplished together. And I think in the end we really did have a partnership. I like that word, partnership. I think it has a lot of meaning. And while I did lose one business partnership, I kept the partnership with my former partners, who have remained my good friends, and now we're working together on other matters, and also with the families. And so I really, that was a gift back, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you so much. So, yeah.
Now my question.
Go ahead. Oh, then it's the nice guy. All right.
How do you feel about the EPA now?
How do I feel about the EPA now? Oh, I feel that they have certainly, they have learned a tremendous amount through this. And I also look at it politically and historically. When we started the case, it was the Reagan years, and maybe many of you remember Burford and Lavelle. Remember those years? Yeah. And those were very, that's when Region 1 was, felt itself actually, under siege, and actually felt itself, in many ways, many of its, the employees there were looking at themselves as insurrectionists, because the stuff from coming from the top was, directly contrary to what they wanted to do as employees. Now, as far as, one of the things that we accomplished by doing this thing was that we were able to go where the EPA did not have the political courage to go. In other words, they came out with their March 82 report and said, look, we see this data, but we can't say who's responsible. And we said, look, we looked at the data, and it's very clear it's coming from the Graves property, it's coming from the Beecher's Tannery property. And so we named them. So we gave a name to these properties. Then the EPA was able to, because of that, were able to come to that place. And that really followed all the way through the course of this. We wanted the pump test, and so there was a pump test. We helped gather a lot of data that wouldn't have been gathered. So I'm proud of all those things that we did. And so the families were really the ones out there, because we didn't have the political pressures that the EPA was subjected to, which were quite intense. Now, to their credit, the EPA Region 1 in particular did rise to the occasion. And eventually, after we were exhausted and our war was over, the EPA, again to their credit, said, hey, the information is solid, the companies are responsible, and brought them to a place like this, and they, all got a consensus and worked it out, and now they're part of a $70 million, 50-year, whatever, cleanup. So, to me, it shows me one thing, that government cannot do it on its own, and will not do it on its own, for lots of reasons. Corporations cannot and will not, and communities cannot do it on their own. So we got to do it together. Now, when you put those factors together with everybody with their different kinds of interests, then I think when you have a plan where government and corporations and communities are pooling their limited resources, then the problem has a way of at least the hope of getting solved. And when you don't do that, when it's communities sitting back and saying, government, what have you done for me lately? Or both of them sitting back and saying, corporations, right or wrong, then I think the community goes out of balance, and you have exactly what happened in Woburn. You wake up to find that the water that you thought was safe is not. So if you want to keep your water safe, your air safe, you want to keep your community safe, then the community must be an active partner in the process. And I mean a partner in all those means. It means you must be reasonable, you must be rational, you must be organized, you must be willing to pool your limited resources and be as respectful of others' limited resources as you are of your own. Now, when that happens, then there's a chance of us getting it right, both finding out about the past and also having future. And when you don't have that, you have a community out of balance, and then you have problems that don't get solved.
Book and movie have their own versions, of course, of what made you decide to take this case.
Yes.
And I'd like to hear you address
that. Okay, that's a wonderful question, and I've asked that many times, and I've been doing lots of soul searching. I have one. This case introduced me to my soul. I have a working relationship with my soul. We may not always agree with each other, but I respect my soul. As before, I didn't acknowledge I had one. So it was one of the gifts the family gave me to realize I did have one. What was it? Well, I can talk about what I think, but you have the book and you have the movie, and you have this experience too. But let me give you my take on it. When the families came to me, they told me the story. You're all familiar with it. I won't repeat it. And I certainly was touched on a human level, and I believe I was then a human being, had human values. But as a lawyer, this was not a case for me. I just didn't have the experience or the wisdom or the resources to be able to do this. But the families wouldn't say no. And so, because I think of good parts about me, I couldn't say no to them. So I decided to go knock on the doors of those who had more experience and more resources. you know, and found out why they had more experience and resources. You know, no, we can't take this case. You know, we're too busy. So I went back to the families, and I told them in a room like this, you know, look, I can't do this. You remember that time. But you know what they did to me? You know, here's how I will use this metaphor. They held up their children, and they said, don't you get it? You see, our children are choking to death on the lies. We need the truth. Now, I said, yes, but, you know, the thing that you're asking me to do, this, you know, this thing you say you need, I have to go and get. Now, and to get it, I got to go invade the land of the thing makers. They don't take kindly to invasion. And, you know, there'll be a lot of challenge and danger. So let me get back to you. Then I started checking out the signs. And the signs pointed to two of the largest thing makers in the world, W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods. And I said, my God, there'll be more challenge I've ever had in my life. There'll be more danger than I ever had in my life. And I heard the rumors. You know the rumors. That there are, well, things buried on that property. Valuable things. And valuable things that if you unburied them, why? Why, people would pay, well, huge sums to possess. I didn't even think of it all. You know, all of it. You know, I thought about the children. And I thought about the need. I thought about the challenge and the treasure, all of it. And it all worked on my mind. And this experience captured me on every level a human being can be captured. And that was its blessing and that's its curse. And Kevin, my very good friend, said it's a black hole. And it was. It had a gravitational pull to it that once you were in it, there was no escaping. And you just were brought to another side of the universe. So it was, you know, it was good. It was bad. Okay, maybe a little ugly. But it was all of those things, on all of those levels. You know, I'm a human being. I'm not ashamed of being human. And I'm not ashamed of being captured on all of those levels. And I couldn't have been, you know, 100% on that case unless I was captured on all of those levels. And I was. And that's my explanation. And now when I went on that journey, once captured, because once you pay the admission price, you know, there's no leaving. There's no exits. We went on this journey. And then it was a journey into science and medicine and law. Legal system, a personal and a spiritual journey, you know, and I learned all about the world, you know, that I could not have learned any other way. It took me out of my comfortable world, and I'll use the metaphor in the movie. You know, the movie has that wonderful metaphor of the water that everyone in the movie drinks. I'm sure you all noticed that. Everyone drank that water, and that water was poison. And when I went outside the comfortable world, I realized, looking back in, we were all drinking poison water. We were all poisoning our water. How are we going to get the poison out? Together, we'll get it out. And that's what the place that the families left me when the journey ended, and I had to go on my own. Yeah.
Yeah, you talked about win-win games or games. It seems that...
No, I don't think win-win games. I can trivialize a little bit, but I talk about... But I mean accommodating others, recognizing and accommodating interests, which I think is how human beings learn to live together.
And I'm hearing many truths with this case, and I think for plaintiffs, and if not in this case, certainly in many cases, the only way that they can win in their own minds is for the other side to lose. And
that's where I disagree. So, you finish.
Yeah, and I guess why would you disagree? I think it is that way. I don't know that it has to be that way, but how do you get to that? How do you convince a plaintiff where the only way that they hired you to shoot the SOB?
That's the point.
The only way that they're going to be
that's happy. Exactly the point. Exactly the point. You see, when they came into my office, the families told me their story, and when I looked at it, I said, well, they have this problem. My job is, can I make a case out of it? Now, at first, I thought I couldn't. So, no, I don't want anything to do with this problem that you have. It's your problem. But when I thought, oh, I can make a case out of it, and what could happen if I did was successful, hey, give me that problem of yours. You know, like it's commodity, and I'll go get the thing that makes me win this case. I'll extract the truths from the other side, you know, all those buried secrets. So that's how I looked at the world. Now, if you look at that world that way, then you'll get Woburn. And sometimes there'll be Woburn cases in which the companies win, and sometimes there'll be when the community wins, as we have come to, you know, in that world, describe it. But I'll tell you, I don't care who wins. If any of them win and one of them loses, then as far as I'm concerned, we have all lost. Now, why would I say such a thing? If you know, people say, oh, you know, the people who review this movie, you know, they say, oh, that poor son of a bitch. you know, he was so deluded and obsessed that he gave up all the things in life. Yeah, I did. For the most important thing in life. You know, and that's what Woburn was all about. It was telling us. It is. That's why we're all here today. Woburn tells us there is something more important than all the things in life. The only thing in life. Life. And now, when you understand that, you know, that, and then you understand that there cannot be any winners and losers, you know, for life. You know, it's either life or death. And we're all part of life. You know, and then, I came to appreciate that when we shared experience, you know, we actually were creating soil for life to take root. You know, I think that metaphor, you know, is a true one. That because it's when we, you know, when we talk to each other openly and honestly and we understand how we got here, then we have a chance to have a future, to have another day, better than the day we had before. But when we fight over it, this is this model you're talking about. Oh, come in. They have wronged me. They have poisoned my children. They must be destroyed. They have tried to destroy the community. You now must destroy them. Now, if you go to Woburn now, the Grace Plant is just a hollow shell. Now, inside, it is cleaning up the water, and that's a good thing. But that company now is an economic entity, is no longer there. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but recognize that. The tannery is all closed. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's now an ice cream factory and an environmental testing lab. I think those are good things, okay? But what I'm saying is that I don't like the win or lose. One side must destroy the other, because in that process of destroying, we lose a certain thing, which is the wisdom and also the destruction of limited resources, time and money and people. We can't afford to lose any of them. We all got to the problem together. We all get out of it together. And anyone who thinks that you can sacrifice, if a company thinks they can sacrifice the community and have a future, now, of course, that's wrong. Well, the reverse is true. The community cannot sacrifice the industry, right, and still have a future, because that's the kind of life we have chosen to have. You know, we've come, you know, 5,000 years, you know, to that place. Industry is part of our life, and the same. So that's my answer.
This just jumps into my head. I'm just going to throw it at you. This is a question. If the Earth were a living entity,
yes,
in a biology lab,
right,
could a biologist be correct in assessing that humanity is an injection of cancer?
Well, one could say that if humanity acts like a virus, or let me ask you to say this, that you're using the natural world as the metaphor, that to me the greatest lesson of the natural world is, you know, symbiotic behavior. That nature thrives, life thrives in nature almost always through symbiotic behavior, through one life form working with another life, accommodating the interests of another life form so they both can have life. I mean, that really is the, you know, from that's by far, you know, it's 95 or 98%. Now, there's another 2%. I'm trying to work on why exactly that is, but so I'm saying is I like the symbiotic as opposed to the parasitic. You know, suck out all the blood, host dies, okay, better find another host, you know, or you're going to die. But the one in which you're both sustaining each other, I think I like that one better. That offers me more hope. So I look at humanity as one, and the planet's getting smaller as we're, you know, interconnecting with each other. And so I don't see any of us losing on that. You know, we cannot lose, we all lose. We have to figure it out together how we get it right in order to thrive. That's just my basic premise. Woburn taught me that. I don't know. Woburn did not give me, at the end of this process, a metaphor that said that the conflict-based metaphor, the war metaphor, where one side wins and the other side loses, works. I don't like having a discussion of why, you know, is Judge Skinner a bad person or not? Or Jerry Thatcher, did he make mistakes? Or did Jan, make this mistake, whatever? While I think those are interesting discussions, I think in the end they deserve us if they become the distractions for the ultimate lesson, which is, did we have a system that brought out the best in us and helped everyone solve the problem by recognizing truly what was going on? Or did we have a system that was so distorted and so distorting that it caused, you know, people to make terrible choices and terrible decisions, which compounded and compounded and became a pathology that infected everyone, and we all were the worst for it. I want a system in which it encourages the best out of us, not the worst, and our system does not do that.
Yeah, maybe you could just do one.
Sure. I don't know if that's possible, but go ahead.
All right.
what's the incentive for a company like Grace or for the tobacco industry or any number of companies, what's the incentive for them to adopt a system different than what we have now?
But they are doing it. Necessity.
Well, no.
It's a real mother. But they are. Tobacco is doing that.
What was the incentive that caused them to do it?
What was the incentive? For all the things, good, bad, and ugly, in the human soul. Self-preservation, political realpolitik.
Do you believe that with the goodness of the human soul, the cost?
No, no, no. I didn't say goodness. Did I have goodness in there? No, no. Self-preservation.
Okay.
All right? You know, people do lots of things for self-preservation. You know, murderers do things for self-preservation. You know, I can't think of a more evil industry. Tobacco couldn't be more evil. You know, they... I mean, what industry kills off its best customers every year and then looks for the young in order to replace them? I mean, my God, so pretty evil. But this evilness, this pathology, this pathologic institution is not out there in the world. It's in us. You know, it's in our body. If you looked at the United States as one human being, you know, and you said to it, hey, tobacco good or bad, you know, it'd really be in conflict. Well, you know, I know smoking's not good for you, but, you know, I got these taxes over here, and, you know, and I need it for, you know, to bring customers into my store, and, you know, go on and on and on and on, okay? So what I'm saying is that how do you make a sick person well? How do you make a country that is sick with this pathology well? And the point is you've got to start civilizing that pathology, and that's the process that is actually taking place now. Now, you know, it took hard, challenging work. They had 50 years, an unbroken record of success in the court. 50 years, cigarette. And I dare say today that the chances of a tobacco company winning in a court of law are pretty good odds, on whatever issue you care to name, for all the kinds of reasons, and we don't have to go into them. But they are changing, and they did change when something fundamental happened, when plaintiff's lawyers made a fundamental decision they had never done before. Do you all know what it was? They formed a partnership. They gave up a little control. They formed a partnership between plaintiff's lawyers and the government. Whoa! And people, they created an animal nobody ever seen before. And that little partnership was a big message to this other entity, the company, saying, oh my goodness, we're feeling a little uneasy here. You know, it's not feeling real comfortable in this room. You know, there's too many. You know, I can do this, but now you're on both sides. And that started a process, a civilizing process, in which they start accommodating interests. Now, I believe the process that's been set in motion is going to continue building on, and the companies will eventually be civilized out of existence, as they should be. But that's the body having, you know, allowing the tumor to shrink, as opposed to grabbing the body and ripping it open and trying to cut out the tumor that has metastasized to its brain and to its heart and to its soul. So to me, that offers a hope that we will, you know, resolve this. It takes time. Like any, you know, it took time to get sick, it'll take time to get well. So it's because they're evil that you have to do this thing. There is no alternative to getting better than getting well. Now, they come to the room. You know, I give you another example. Groton, Massachusetts. Community with contaminated water, two companies on the hill, it's always two. Sick children with learning disabilities, and they came to me. We applied the lessons of Woburn. They formed the Concerned Citizens Against Contamination. And then we went in partnership to the state government. Then we went up to the hill and knocked on the doors of the company. You know what they said? I said, look, I'm a plaintiff's lawyer. I'm here to help. They slammed the door on my face. Then we went down the hill. I called. They wouldn't answer the phone call. I went back up the hill. They wouldn't answer the door. Okay. Well, we formed a partnership with the state government. We formed a partnership with the local government. We started partnerships with the state and local and federal politicians. Formed partnerships with absolutely everyone except them. And they made a phone call. Hey, listen, would you mind coming up? We got some things to talk about. And so we did. Now, it took a long time. It was not easy. Now, if you want drama and conflict, we had plenty of that. You know, and some of this hair is missing, you know, through that experience. And some of it is gray because of a little leftover from Woburn that was dark came gray through this. But at the end of it, we formed a partnership agreement, actually signed a partnership agreement in 1991. We're in partnership now, the eighth year of that partnership. And here's what the partnership did. The town got all this response costs back for hooking the community up to water. The community got a health protection fund, a property protection fund, and a health security fund, all negotiated items, all difficult and challenging, but it worked to everybody's satisfaction. Everybody got a cleanup at the front end, not the back end. The company got something never had before. That was the community as a partner, and we went in partnership to the regulators to deal with all the kinds of issues so that they got regulatory certainty, they got reasonableness, and they got to concentrate on what they do best, which is doing business. And then we gave something to the rest of the world. Because nobody was fighting, because we're all in partnership. We invited in the federal government and the state government to do a unique health study, which they did, to see if there was a relationship between children with learning disabilities, which everybody was concerned about, and these chemicals in the water. And at the end of their study, they said, yeah, there's a relationship. More water, more risk of learning disabilities. That's a gift for the rest of the world. Now, all of those things were accomplished. There was no litigation. We went into court one time to get it approved for the children. Now, I think that's sane. That makes sense. Now, they're a corporation with all the malevolencies and all the goodness and all the other kinds of things that corporations are subject to, and the community is like any other community, and the town is like any other town. There's nothing special, except they decided to try something new. Hey, it worked. Well, we offer that as kind of another vision, an alternative to what we had to do in Woburn. And I'm proud of what we did in Woburn, but as a veteran of, you know, war who survived, I say, hey, why war? Okay.
Thank you very much. That was right. Excellent. Great, I didn't have a Woburn, but I like to think I've evolved soon.
I didn't bring the bagel, but I did bring the cream cheese. If anybody has a half a bagel, I didn't have breakfast. This is, as Charlie said in the introduction, a day devoted to education, not a day devoted to controversy or personality. So I want to talk about some of the aspects that would be of interest to people who are teaching law and talking about law. And I have been talking to law students now for more than 30 years, 29 years as a teacher, and almost every other year as a visiting lecturer here or there. So I love to talk to students, and I view you as students and teachers. I want to talk to you in the time we have about three or four what I consider to be the myths of this case and the ironies of this case, and then open it up to any kind of question you want to ask, from what is John Travolta really like, which is what you're all interested in, not what Jerry Fasher is really like, to anything else you want to talk about in the area of education or legal issues. I want to talk first and foremost about the distorted picture of the trial judge, which those of us who are lawyers and those of us who are members of the concerned public ought to be aware of. And the book especially provides a particularly unfair view of one of the best judges that we've had in Massachusetts in many years. The movie, which will neither long endure nor be long remembered, provides a lesser hysterical version, but the movie will pass into video and soon be beyond recall. But the book is going to live for a long time, and those of you who teach classes or those of you who talk to students ought to know first and foremost that there is a very distorted view of the judge. And that's not based on my view as the prevailing attorney, although you always know that winning attorneys always like the judges they appear before, and losing attorneys never like the judges they appear before. But it's based on fact and on the record. This was a very complicated, difficult case. Very complicated, high-profile case. And the judge knew it. And the judge was well aware of the fact that he was dealing with, a high-profile case, and, B, counsel who were not as experienced in complex litigation as those of us on the other side, and also that it was important to give every break, if it could be given, to the party that had brought the case. Now, that sounds odd, but you want to look at the record. What do plaintiffs care about? What do I care about when I'm a plaintiff? And I've been a plaintiff many, many, many times. What do you care about? You care about getting to the jury. You care about keeping your case in court. You care about getting over the rail. That's what plaintiffs care about. Because once they get to the jury, then all bets are off. You have a kind of crap game that happens with jury discussions, and you have the fear or the delight of juries going to extremes. So that's what plaintiffs care about. And in every important aspect of this case, Judge Skinner kept the plaintiffs in the ballgame, starting from day one to day 78. Every important motion that would have thrown the plaintiff out of court was decided favorably to the plaintiff. He denied Rule 11, he denied summary judgment, he denied a directed verdict, and that's the scary time in a trial lawyer's life, a directed verdict, when you stand there waiting to see whether you're going to get over the rail. He denied directed verdict, he let in an expert opinion that no judge would let in. Even Jan wouldn't have let in that opinion. And he denied... What? He denied a motion for a directed verdict at the close of the evidence, and he let the case go to the jury. So that every important aspect that plaintiffs care about, and that Jan cared about, getting over the rail, he decided in the plaintiff's favor. Now, there were certain aspects of the case he chopped down as it went along, but you start out with a judge who was well aware of what he was doing. He also, from time to time, as Jan will attest, conducted trial practice sessions trying to demonstrate how certain things ought to be put in evidence, how certain foundations ought to be laid, and those all took place at the bench. He was nobody that I knew well at all, despite what were then probably the plaintiff's fears or obsessions. Judge Skinner and I were not even minimally acquainted, except for my appearance before him in two cases that I had lost. We were not on any kind of first-name basis ever, even to this day. I was an Orthodox Jew from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. I certainly was not in the same strata or social upbringing or class or whatever you want to call it of Judge Skinner, who was a strict kind of Yankee judge. So there was none of that. He was a no-nonsense judge. He lost patience with me. He lost patience with Jan. If anybody has a year off, you can read the record, and you can read his admonitions to me that I was putting the jury to sleep, that I should get on with it. You can you can read about Jan saying that he had a short fuse and he was apologizing for being uncivil. That happens in every single trial. But as I said, when you look at the record, every one of those important decisions was made that kept the plaintiff in the game. And that's all you could ask for. Or it's plenty for a plaintiff to work with. And the plaintiff had plenty of evidence to work with. So that's the first myth that I think is engendered by the book. And as I say, as lawyers, as teachers, as students, don't believe me. Throw a rock down State Street. The first person you hit will be a lawyer. Ask the lawyer, what do you think of Judge Skinner? And he will tell you that he's a balls and strikes kind of guy, right down the middle, within the white lines, straight as you can get. So that point I want to make clearly. I can take all the hits that anybody has to hand out, but the judge is defenseless and cannot defend himself. There's no forum for him. And since he's a senior judge and no longer sitting, and since I have no client and do not represent Beatrice, and I'm not here representing or in any way talking for Beatrice, because there is no Beatrice, you can take my word for it or not. But ask your friends around Cambridge. Ask your friends in the federal court. And you will not find among the court staff, among the people that appear before him, among the people who have lost cases, including myself, any of the implications that are suggested in the book. Now, secondly, the myth of bifurcation, trifurcation, what the hell kind of word was that, Jan? Quintrification. We just had octuplets. You could have done that one. Octuplication, whatever the hell it is. I mean, if you can use a big word, use it, because we're lawyers. Don't use little words. Use big words. Don't talk about dividing up the case. And don't talk about obscuring. It's got to be obfuscation, you know. We lawyers are great. We think because we go for 7 years, that gives us the right to use these four-syllable words instead of talking English like the rest of mankind. What was the issue in, I'll call it bifurcation, actually it was divided the case into three phases. It wasn't all that complicated. It's happened to me. I lost a big case last year, same thing. The judge decided to trifurcate the case. Even worse, Jan, and what happened to you? I couldn't put in the evidence by direct testimony. The evidence came in by affidavit. How'd you like to try a case by affidavit as your direct case? Would that have been thrilling? Put in, what's your name? My name is so-and-so. Then you sit down, and the other guy gets up and whacks the hell out of your witness. That's a wonderful way to put in a direct case. So I'm not complaining about that. You can see that. Anyway, bifurcation. The case was an unmanageable case, and I'm talking about unmanageable from a judicial point of view in the form in which it was presented. And you can agree or disagree, but you should know the facts and make up your own mind. You had 35 plaintiffs. You had 8 deaths. You had 100, maybe, I don't know, 50, 100 different kinds of illnesses, all the way from rashes and diarrheas and mental problems to leukemias and melanomas and all the terrible injuries and sufferings that the plaintiffs had endured. You had 100, we had about 35 experts in every kind of discipline: geology, hydrogeology, geohydrology, chemistry, soil chemistry, waste disposal, water treatment, water distribution, cardiology, neurology, urology, hematology, immunology, epidemiology, psychiatry. I mean, half the things I didn't even know what they were, let alone able to become familiar. You can't throw all that stuff in front of a jury in one big mishmash. If you want, this is obviously an advocate talking, but it makes sense. If you want to get a fair result. If you really are looking for truth instead of just something based on emotion, you saw the movie. You saw the movie, didn't you? So a lot of you saw the movie. What's the first scene of the movie? Terrific first scene. Probably didn't happen, but it's a terrific first scene. Wonderful scene. Into the courtroom comes a paraplegic in a wheelchair. And I'm sure that was an actual victim. And into the courtroom comes a paraplegic and sits in front of the jury, center of attention. And you have these hard-ass lawyers for the Mass General sitting over there, you know, looking at the jury. Then you have the jury looking at the sick person. And then this, of course, this is the way we do it. This is the way we settle cases. We take little post-its and we write numbers. And when we write numbers, then Jan makes a little motion with his head. Now, we do that all the time, isn't that right? That's the way I give away big money. I mean, I do it all by post-it. But anyway, the point is, and then we look up. Zaylian is kind of a genius, the screenwriter. I mean, he's invented some wonderful dialogue. Some of the best things I never said are in that movie. And probably Jan, too. And what do you see? You look up and you see the juror, and you look up and you see the women juror, and then all of a sudden, little tear starts coming down. How they get them to cry, I have no idea. A little tear comes down in the camera. You can see the little tear coming down. And then the guy busily is writing on the post-it again. And finally, he writes $2 million, I guess it was, please, which is another interesting reflection. It was the please that settles the case. Please take my money. And the case settles, and then we break into the credits and the rock music and the scene of the Charles, and we're off and running. But that ain't what happens, you know that. But what does happen is that sympathy takes over. Those people at the Mass General may not have been worried about the facts. Maybe they were. I don't know what the facts were. It might have been a very easy liability. It may have been a tough liability. But you could see from the way the movie was structured that the point was that you can't decide these cases or shouldn't decide these cases on sympathy. But it isn't sympathy alone. Think of the mishmash of geology and medicine and damages and liability, families sandwiched between geologists, medical people sandwiched between family members, immunologists coming in with statistics. We had every kind of conceivable discipline. So it made judicial sense to bifurcate or trifurcate. These are not new ideas. They happen all the time. Plaintiffs don't like them. I'm not particularly thrilled with them myself, because everybody likes to start off with somebody that'll make a tear come to the eye of the jury, obviously. I'd be silly not to know that. But Jan had Plan B, which was also a good plan. And that's why I said on the movie last night, which I wasn't particularly thrilled with either, but that's another story for another harangue. There was not a particular high degree of consternation evidenced. Because, and maybe there was back at the office, I doubt very much Jan went around smashing valuable things. I doubt that very much. Not because he was as frugal as I was, but because he wasn't that erratic and he wasn't that impulsive. And when we first met, I have to say, as I told his mother, he was very polite. He was deferential to me, and we got along fine. Somewhere the case took a turn. That's 13, 14 years ago, and it's history. But when we first met, he was just I thought, if you'll forgive me, Jan, I thought basically he seemed to me insecure in at the time. And obviously he was likable and charismatic. So I wasn't having any particular grudge fight with him. As I say, it took a turn somewhere. Forget it. But the point is, if I can remember the point, that the bifurcation was important. But, and those of us that teach trial practice know this, there's two ways to get the BAFO feeling into your case. One is at the beginning, but when you've done it at the beginning and you haven't done it well, you're lost and you've got nothing left but dull geological and medical and all kinds of technical testimony. And the other is the way that the plaintiffs fell back on or would have fallen back on. And that was, we'll get rid of all this early technical crappies early. We'll get through all these geologists and all these waterworks, groundwater geology phase, and then the defendants are going to be left naked to their enemies, because all they've got left facing them are all these families, and they're going to come on one after another, and the kids are going to come on, the stories of the kids are going to come on, and the medicine is going to come on, and there's going to be one hell of a BAFO finale. So the plaintiffs, I don't think, were all that desolate. They didn't like it. The ruling itself obviously was not appealed. It wouldn't have been appealable anyway because it was within the judge's discretion. But there was still a way to get these families on the stand. And in many respects, you could argue it would have been a better way if the plaintiffs had been able to stay the course. Because you will remember that Grace was left alone after Beatrice was found not liable. And the original plan of the plaintiffs was to demonstrate that they had enough assets and enough resources to run in the big leagues and to make us work as hard as anybody would ever have made us work. And after that, get a settlement from one plaintiff and use it to fund the rest of the case against the, from one defendant, I'm sorry, and use it to fund the rest of the case against the other defendant, which was a good strategy. It was a strategy I suggested to Jan very early in the case, when indeed, unlike the Four Seasons, which he treated me to, he came over for a cup of coffee and a paper cup, and it was at that occasion, unlike the movie has it all wrong, of course, but I was bouncing the ball against the wall, and he and Kevin, and maybe Gordon, was Gordon there? Gordon was there, and I was saying to him, and he didn't really take it as a threat. It says in the movie he threatened me, but I mean, the man is 2 feet taller than I am. I did threaten to strike him in the courtroom. I'm glad you didn't take me up on that. I said, you and Charlie, I'll take you both on. We'll go out in the hallway and settle it. Real civilized way of settling cases. But that was a good strategy. Where it went awry, Jan or Kevin or Jonathan, will be able to tell you, or might be able to tell you, because when I first called him over for a cup of coffee, I did say to him, I heard you got $1 million from UniFirst. I want to give you some money. I'm not going to give you that much, but I can get you something. And I had in mind $999,999.99, because I had my own ego problems. And I wanted to say, I never gave anybody $1 million in my life to settle a case, and that was the reason. And I don't know whether I mentioned the number, but he got the feeling it was close to $1 million, but not quite $1 million. And one of the things I couldn't get from the plaintiffs, and I don't know whether he'd do it differently or not, but I couldn't get a figure. Couldn't get any figure. And I think that's not a great thing if you're a plaintiff not to tell a defendant how much money you want. But anyway, that was the problem. And that's indeed in the office when we took out the $20 bill, which they show in the movie as a corridor conference, a scene which never happened, and was completely the screenwriter's invention. It was probably a good scene, and they have a lot of cynical dialogue by me about, you thought we were talking about a court of law, stuff like that. Conversations which never took place. We had very few conversations anyway, but that one didn't take place. But I did put the $20 bill on the table, not to make an offer, but to illustrate how ridiculous he was, or I thought he was being, in not giving me an offer, in not insulting me, and not at least giving me a number. And so the thrust of it was, if I put 6 zeros behind this, you'd jump in a minute. It was supposed to be one of those ridiculous examples to prove your point. So that's what occurred. But anyway, the theory was to get the money from one defendant. And after all, they did use the Uniferse money to fund the case against us, and then use it against the other defendants. And somewhere it went awry, and maybe that's one of the untold stories, because the second myth, the third myth, I don't know how many myths I got up to by now, that I want to talk about, and I'm glad Jan is here, and I've said this in other places, is this David and Goliath myth. This idea that it was the little guy against the big guy, and the little guy is helpless and so forth. I don't doubt the general principle that takes place, but in this case, they had a terrific strategy. And this strategy was, this case is going to be Goliath against Goliath, or Goliath against somebody even smaller than Goliath. And therefore, they decided that they were going to do this, matching us expert for expert, motion for motion, deposition for deposition, argument for argument, whatever it was, they were going to do it. They were going to do it better. They were going to do it more expensively than we were. And that was also a very successful strategy. You fooled me. You fooled the hell out of me. You eventually fooled yourself, but you fooled me. I thought, these guys have got the Bank of England behind them. These guys have got all the money in the world. I did not know till I read the book that they were in bad financial straits, that they were funded, if it's true, by, or at least helped in funding from the Bank of Boston. They did a wonderful job. And again, somewhere it went awry because they had me completely fooled. I was convinced. And so was everybody else. I don't see Mike Keating, but Mike would tell you, anybody will tell you. I mean, we saw experts that were not, sleazy experts crawling out from under a rock somewhere. We saw good experts. We saw them meeting in hotels in Chicago for conferences. We saw guys being flown across the state. We saw testing. I mean, you can't look at these medical records and not say, oh, my God, that must have cost a fortune, what they were doing with all the medicals. And we saw geologists all over the place, all over the place. And, you just don't have a feeling for the way money was being spent. So we were really on the defensive. When I say we, I'm talking about Beatrice and the lawyers that were representing Beatrice, and Grace, too. But the cases against the two defendants were different. And the case against Beatrice was much weaker and much more difficult to prove. And I don't want to get into an argument about the science and all the rest of that stuff. But any lawyer would look at those cases and say, the weaker case, the tougher case, if you want to call it, is against Beatrice. You got different geology over here. You got a river. You got and up there you got Grace, and you got Grace at the top of a hill, and you got the wells. And, you know, it was a different case. And also, the lawyers were different. So I said to Jan, and he'll remember it. You don't want me in this case. Get rid of me. I'm going to be a pain in the ass. You don't want me. You've got two deep pockets. You only need one. Do it. Well, you know, the money may not have been attractive at that point, but that was basically their strategy, and as I say, it was a good strategy. And I don't know what would have happened had they had not, according to the book, according to the movie, run out of money and been actually forced, I guess, to take an offer that Jan didn't think was adequate. So the David and Goliath, and also in the courtroom, there wasn't any lack of representation in the courtroom. And there's a lot of talk about, well, he got his experience and he wasn't, you know, maybe didn't handle a case. He knew his case. They knew their case very well. They were very well equipped on the science. They were very well equipped on the facts. He knew as much medicine and geology. He could tell you the water levels of every water, of every well, where it was dug and when it was dug, and all the rest of it. He knew the parts per billion of every chemical. So that part was good. There wasn't, you know, wasn't quite as polished in the asking of questions, and he would admit that now. Of course, I offered him a free course in trial practice. I told him to come over and attend the classes, but he was too busy. Anyway. Yes, it did turn out. Obviously, I didn't know the money was borrowed, but the strategy worked. And one of the untold stories is why you didn't deal with, or they didn't deal with the weaker case. The other thing was, of course, the concentration on the Beatrice case. I would have, people say to me, well, would you have tried the case differently? What would you have done? Well, first of all, I would have tried as hard as I could to settle the case, but I wouldn't have concentrated on Beatrice. I would have concentrated on the stronger, or at least the apparently stronger case, because he had a usage at the Grace plant, which he couldn't prove or demonstrate at the, and he tried awful hard. And we had some friendly discussions about whether he tried too hard. But he couldn't demonstrate the use of the chemicals at Beatrice, but he could at Grace. Runtel's employees. I'm still looking for my first Runtel employee. Mr. Tommy. So that was another myth, or another irony, if you want to call it that, because it did feel like Goliath against a smaller Goliath. And the enormous complexity of the case was handled very well. Those are some of the ironies. There are some other interesting things about the case, the whole Rule 11 beginning and end, which is very unique in the annals of trials. Rule 11 being denied at the beginning of the case, being granted at the end of the case. And I could see why the plaintiff would be upset, but it was based on the plaintiff's own files. And I think the plaintiff, Jan in particular, probably should have testified. He had his own reasons and his own philosophy, which were arguably correct. But here was a situation where the judge was looking into a report and was trying to find out what the importance of the report was. And maybe in retrospect, testimony would have helped. And plaintiff, if anything, has always been a very articulate, charismatic champion of the causes. But that was unique from a teaching point of view. Forget the merits and who's right and who's wrong. You can argue that forever. From a teaching standpoint, think about it. You have Rule 11 denied at the front of the case and granted at the back end of the case. We have a judge asking lawyers to testify. We have cross-examination. of lawyers, and we have a judge examining the plaintiff's own investigative file. Unique things in the trial practice. In the new trial motion, we had 78 days of trial, and then we had a new trial motion based on a report that hadn't been produced and the significance of the report. And again, I'm not going to argue back and forth about who shot whom, but the interesting part about the teaching of this case is that nobody in this room has ever heard of an evidentiary hearing on a new trial motion. It's practically unheard of. And we argued 3 days, 3 full days of argument about a new trial. And Jan and Charlie Nesson and others argued it. And usually, I mean, 99 out of 100, maybe 999 out of 1,000 new trial motions are routinely denied. Some judges tell you in advance, I never grant new trials. I never try things twice. That's why they have appeals court. And after that, and again, credit is due where it's due. Jan and Charlie, they persevered, and they got the Court of Appeals to order an evidentiary hearing, which is a unique thing. I don't know if there's a refund. Are there any other cases? I've never seen that done. I mean, that's unique. If you're talking about teaching, forget about the personality, forget about whether Jan and I loved each other or made up or anything else, and we have mutual respect. I say that here. The teaching aspect is fantastic. I don't know what those of you who are teachers have ever read Judge Selya's opinion. He's a First Circuit judge. There are always 20 words in there you can't understand. You have to read his opinions with a dictionary. He probably writes them with a thesaurus. And so you're looking at these words and what the hell does that mean? Which is not exactly what should be done in the opinions that other judges are trying to follow. So that's a unique aspect. And in between, there are the unique aspects. I mean, you can legitimately argue, which I think, from a legal aspect, the plaintiffs feel probably more strongly about is the strict liability aspect of the case, which was went out with a directed verdict, but the rest of the case went to the jury. And you can argue that. Those are things proper to talk about in law school classes. So those are some of the myths, some of the ironies, and that's enough for me. Is there anybody that would like to ask me anything or accuse me of anything? I can't lose this case ever. I can't lose it on court TV. I can't lose it here. I lived here for 29 years, so ask away. Yes, sir.
Well, my question goes to your person about the distinct field of Jonathan Farr was suggesting that Judge Skinner was unfair. I'll report to you that in talking to colleagues about this, the book, some people have that impression and some people don't, which I think may be a testament to how it lays out the facts, including the ones you mentioned. But when I read it, I thought that might be true, and the only reason I thought so is that there seemed to be just the Rule 11 aspect. That at the end of the case, there's Rule 11 against Schlickman, but not against the firm representing the co-defendants. And
it was that firm was sanctioned. They were sanctioned.
They were, yeah. But there's, well, the question was whether, I guess then, whether the evidence that was withheld was sufficient for a new trial. If there was any unfairness, it seemed to me that is what it was about. And I'm not even sure the author says that that's unfair, so it leaves that to the reader to decide. And I think I agree with what you're saying, that this is a very complex case, and that one has to take that into account, assessing those judges. Do you really think that R is really
make
it clear that Judge Skinner is unfair, and if so, how?
Well, you get that impression when you read the book. Most lawyers certainly in this jurisdiction got that impression, and you get it from the time that's devoted to the plaintiff's view where Jonathan was stationed and the defendant's view. And for example, the lack of emphasis on Rule 11 on what the basis of Rule 11 was. The basis was the plaintiff's own file. Now, you have to trash the judge if you're going to get away from that finding, or you have to have a serious disagreement. But the judge's finding was that there wasn't a rumor, there wasn't a whisper, there wasn't even an anonymous tip to indicate that there was any evidence against Beatrice. Now, maybe there was. I don't know what he had in his file. I didn't see it. It was done in camera. But the opinion, those of you who are educators and read the opinion says that the plaintiff's own investigators had investigated and had indicated that there wasn't any evidence against the tannery. Bear in mind that the tannery came into the case very late. The emphasis, and this is accurate, as Jan knows, was on the so-called 15 acres, not on the tannery, because the 15 acres were very badly polluted. And always were polluted. And the question was, who polluted them and what was the responsibility of the landowner? For the EPA, that's an easy answer. The easy answer is you own the land, you clean it up. For a tort lawyer, it's a different answer because you've got to prove false, you've got to prove negligence. And we can talk about whether juries are the right forum for this kind of complex action or whether we should be, as Jan is now advocating or at least talking about, get these things mediated, get talking started early, and see if you can bring, I don't think that brings truth, but it may bring resolution to the controversy instead of declaring war. But I think most lawyers did think that Judge Skinner did get a short shrift. And Jonathan was not being malicious about it. It was he could not, as he said many times, get inside the judge's mind. So what he had to do was deal with what he saw. He couldn't say to the judge, what did you mean by that ruling? No judge can discuss his ruling. And that was the problem. Yes, sir.
The most mysterious ruling of Skinner, to me, the one that seems most biased, is at the very end of the case, the very, very last thing. It's at the end of the book, Mary Daly files an affidavit in which she says that she had messengered this allegedly suppressed Yankee report to Neil Jacobs 2 months before the trial, and the judge refuses to inquire into that.
Well,
is there some basis for her affidavit?
Should
this have blown up the case again?
That whole issue was indeed brought before the judge, despite what the suggestion is. It's a whole complicated story of why Mary, it's Mary Ryan, not Mary Daly. But I don't think that adds very much to legal scholarship, to be honest with you. The fact of the matter is Jan filed, and I don't think we ought to turn this into who was right and who was wrong, but Jan filed at least four of his 31 motions in the last couple of weeks of the post-trial, at least four motions using those affidavits as a basis. And those motions were considered. I don't think we had, and we did have on the 11th of November, 1989, we did have hearings. There was a motion to default and a motion for sanctions and a motion to a stop and so forth. I don't want to concentrate on that matter because I think that is not helpful in the teaching of this case. It was not a ruling that was crucial as to when anybody delivered the report and when a report was seen or wasn't seen. The crucial point was, did the report make any difference? And what all of us should be asking ourselves is, do we believe the findings of the trial judge or don't you? We had a 23-day hearing on that report, 23 days. And if you believe in the system as I do, and I think as the, all most lawyers do, and Jan included, you have to accept, if you're going to be a lawyer within the system, the findings. And 23 days plus 78 days is 111 days, I guess, and 3 days of arguments is 114 days. So the question is, not who saw what when, but was the report of some importance? And what would it have done? And there's a dispute. I'm sure the geologists, when you talk to them, will tell you all about the differing views, and some people think Pinder was great, and some think Pinder was not great. So that's my response. For legal purposes, you ought to look at what are the facts. We are teaching students about facts. We are teaching students about opening their minds, making up your own mind, but at least opening up your mind. As I said to many a class of students, and I see them and they look at me like, all right, you son of a bitch, convince me. Think about just for one moment, just reserve this tiny part of your mind for the fact that somewhere in this great country, somewhere, one corporation, just one, on one occasion, may not be guilty. Just please leave your mind open for that one tiny bit of skepticism about evidence and about the facts. Yes, ask.
On the question that Skinner gave to the jury, I will, and again.
I want to put aside this, the heat of the moment, because there was a lot of heat of the moment. We all get heated at the moment. Jan got heated up at depositions. I've got heated up at depositions. This is the way lawyers operate. And there is more civility. We're trying to work on the problems of civility. We've all had civility problems. We've all had problems with legal Rambos coming in and driving us crazy. So put aside that for the moment. The questions. We worked on those questions endlessly. And, I mean, none of that dialogue in the movie is true. Again, it's wonderful dialogue. And Jan saying you put it in the Japanese and it translated back into English. And I mean, that's great stuff. He never said it. But here's my comment. Now, the questions were difficult. There's no question about it. If it were up to me, I would have made them, and I tried to make them simpler, actually. Believe it or not, I objected. There's 40 pages of objections by me after the charge. 40 pages. Charlie maybe has two or three objections. And we were all there, we remember. It's 40 pages where I went through every instruction, went through everything you said. The questions were hard. The evidence was there. It could be done. And Jan argued and tried to instruct them on how to answer the question. So did the judge. But the first question, now I'm talking strictly Beatrice, the first question was not hard based on the evidence. It wasn't a hard question. The travel times were hard. You had to try to figure out how trichloroethylene moved through the earth and how fast, and I mean, that was stuff I'm no environmental lawyer. I never had an environmental case in my life. It was just another case to me with hard facts. The first question, though, was, did Beatrice use and dispose of this chemical? And then did it get to the wells? And the judge must have told the jury 50 times, if you answer the first question no, the case is over. And from what I read of what the jury did, maybe there's a revisionist history going around now, but from what the jury did, they did not find any evidence on question one, which was the question as to Beatrice. They answered the same question, yes, for Grace, and no for Beatrice. And so that's why I've said that after 8.5 days, the jury understood the first question, which was easy, I thought was easy, and I argued it there, that all you have to do is find that there wasn't any use of this chemical. It's like you don't use vinegar when you make scrambled eggs. It's just not an ingredient. The evidence wasn't there. Jan desperately tried to raise every possible inference, and probably he thinks he did, but again, I'm not going to fight with them about that or raise personalities. The first question I thought was easy. The other questions were difficult. They were answerable. I mean, I would have had, and some judges, like a professor now, senior district judge Keaton, with whom I taught for many years, probably would have had 50 special questions. It would have gone down. We would have been forever trying to argue those. But they were hard. They could be answered. Eventually, the judge ordered a new trial. Whether there was any connection between the settlement and the new trial order, I don't know. I doubt it very much. I don't think that was the type of proceeding that would have gone on. But the first question I thought was, from my point of view, easy, because the judge started out saying he was going to ask these questions. He told him several times. And actually, when we were fighting about the question, and I was talking about this question is compound, that first question was okay as far as Beatrice was concerned. Was okay with the plaintiffs. Now, I don't know whether memories differ as to that or not, but I recall we didn't have a transcript, so there's no way we'll know, just as we didn't have a transcript of the so-called Woodshed Conference. But I don't think they had a real problem with the first question. And in their original questions that they submitted were very similar, except they weren't compound. But the original question that went when we were fighting about the questions was, first you have to decide whether this stuff was used and disposed of, and then got in the water, and then moved, and so forth and so on. So I thought the questions were hard. When you got past number one, I thought the jury did understand them. From what we don't talk to jurors in Massachusetts, so I have no personal knowledge of jurors. But what I read in Haar's book, the jurors said there wasn't a preponderance of the evidence against Beatrice. You can argue about it. I'm not going to retry the case, nor am I going to retry the disputes between personalities. I have respect for all the people on the other side. But that's my view on the questions. And I don't know whether they'll let you get away with another question or not. You want to make it quick?
I'll answer it quick. Oh, sure. Yeah, I feel that one of the reasons the story has really opened the minds of students at Yale Law School is to the professional responsibility course. And a lot of students in that course focus on one really touching line of yours, where you say at your 60th birthday, life is so short, it seems silly to devote it to motions to dismiss. That's what I've done. And a lot of students, after reading that and thinking about careers in corporate law, they wonder, first of all, so I'll ask you for them, first, if you've had any regrets after your very distinguished career in corporate law, and secondly, if you've read the story, Tolstoy's story, The Death of Ivan Ilyich.
So the answer is no to the latter, and then no to the former. But I have to take exception to your describing me as a corporate lawyer or having a life in corporate law. I am not a corporate lawyer. I've never been a corporate lawyer. I deny being a corporate lawyer. I will not ever be a corporate lawyer. I'm a trial lawyer who once in a while works for corporations. I have worked for individuals. I have had the happiest career in the noblest profession that I know. I never spent an unhappy day coming to work. I never regretted for one second ever being a lawyer. It's been exciting. It's been joyful. It's been a marvelous profession, and if you'll ask me to come down and talk to your Yale students, I will tell them that personally. It is a noble profession, and it is well rewarding, both in the philosophical and in the financial sense. So thank you all very much.